You know, some people enjoy composing their own music, chord by chord, and others are happiest when they come across that one perfect song. Work is not a lot different than that. Whether you prefer building your own workflow or using a pre-made template, with Monday.com, you and the team can work in a way that's comfortable for everyone. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com and build your own amazing workflow, or find an awesome template. No judgment.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to Human Circus.
Quote, 10 days ago, I was in Louvain. The city dates from the 11th century, and the population was 42,000. The citizens were brewers, lace makers, and manufacturers of ornaments for churches. The university was the most celebrated in European cities, and still is, or was, headquarters of the Jesuits. I found the city clean, sleepy, and pretty, with narrow, twisting streets and smart shops and cafes. Set in flower gardens were the houses, with red roofs, green shutters, and white walls. Over those that face south had been trained pear trees, their branches heavy with fruit, spread out against the walls like branches of candelabra. The town hall was very old and very beautiful, an example of Gothic architecture, in detail and design, more celebrated even than the town hall of Bruges or Brussels. It was 500 years old, and lately had been repaired with great taste and at great cost. Opposite was the Church of St. Pierre, dating from the 15th century. A very noble building, with many chapels filled with carvings of the time of the Renaissance, in wood, stone, and iron. Near it was the bronze statue of Father Damien, priest of the leper colony in the South Pacific, of which Robert Louis Stevenson wrote. All these buildings are now empty. Statues, pictures, carvings, parchments, archives, all are gone. Money can never restore Louvain. Great architects, dead these 600 years, made it beautiful, and their handiwork belonged to the world. With torch and dynamite, the Germans have turned these masterpieces into ashes, and all the Kaiser's horses and all of his men cannot bring them back again. End quote. Hello and welcome. My name is Devin, and this is Human Circus Journeys in the Medieval World. This is the podcast that covers all things medieval through the stories of its travelers, and it is a podcast that is supported by a Patreon, where the listening is pleasingly early, ad-free, and with extra mini-episodes, where the cost is as little as $1 a month, or as much as makes sense for you, and where you can find the podcast at patreon.com/humancircus. That said, let's get to the story, that of the events of August 25th, 1914. It's something a little different on the podcast today, but there is, as you'll see, a medieval connection there. Connections, even. It is, rather unusually for the podcast, a story of World War I. A story of its opening summer months. but it's also the story of a medieval building, of medieval books, and of efforts to connect modern actions to medieval events, and ones even older. What I want to talk about today is the destruction of Louvain, the burning of much of that Belgian city, around 25 kilometers east of Brussels, and the loss of its library in that opening phase of World War I. The loss of that library's contents. But first, let's start by going back to a Richard Harding Davis story that appeared in the New York Tribune on August 31st, 1914, and brought the news to an American audience. It was the words of Davis, a novelist, playwright, and journalist, that opened this episode. And I'm including them here because I think they give a real taste for how this story was told at the time. Quote, London, August 30. I left Brussels on Thursday afternoon and have just arrived in London. For 2 hours on Thursday night, I was in what for 600 years has been the city of Louvain. The Germans were burning it, and to hide their work, kept us locked in the railway carriages. But the story was written against the sky, was told to us by German soldiers, incoherent with excesses. And we could read it in the faces of women and children being led to concentration camps, and of citizens on their way to be shot. The Germans sentenced Louvain on Wednesday to become a wilderness, and with the German system and love of thoroughness, they left Louvain an empty and blackened shell. The reason for this appeal to the torch and the execution of non-combatants, as given to me on Thursday morning by General von Luttwitz, military governor of Brussels, was this. On Wednesday, while the German military commander of the troops of Louvain was at the Hotel de Ville talking to the burgomaster, a son of the burgomaster, with an automatic pistol, shot the chief of staff and German staff surgeons. Luttwitz claims that this was the signal for the civil guard, in civilian clothes on roofs, to fire upon the German soldiers in the open square below. He said also that the Belgians had quick-firing guns brought from Antwerp. As, for the week the Germans had occupied Louvain and closely guarded all approaches, the story that there was any gun running is absurd. 50 Germans were killed and wounded. For that, said Luttwitz, Louvain must be wiped out. So in pantomime with his fist, he swept the papers across his table. The hotel, he added, was a beautiful building. It is a pity it must be destroyed. But destroyed it was, along with many other buildings. The justification, as that general informed Davis, was guerrilla resistance on the part of Belgians not in uniform. But, much as Davis rejected the possibility of gun running, others ever since have rejected the entire explanation, blaming instead a friendly fire incident among the occupying Germans that got out of control. When, by troop train, we reached Louvain, wrote Davis, the entire heart of the city was destroyed, and fire had reached the Boulevard Tirlemont, which faces the railroad station. The night was windless, and the sparks rose in steady, leisurely pillars, falling back into the furnace from which they sprang. In their work, the soldiers were moving from the heart of the city to the outskirts, street by street, from house to house. In other wars, he continued, I have watched men on one hilltop, without haste, without heat, fire at men on another hill, and in consequence, on both sides, good men were wasted. But in those fights, there were no women and children, and the shells struck only vacant stretches of veldt, or uninhabited mountainsides. At Louvain, It was war upon the defenseless, war upon churches, colleges, shops of milliners and lacemakers. War brought to the bedside and fireside, against women harvesting in the fields, against children in wooden shoes at play in the streets. Davis wrote of seeing English prisoners, and how he was glad that they were there to bear witness as to how the enemy makes a wilderness and calls it war. He wrote of the, quote, broken spires of the Church of St. Pierre, of the rows of houses, some already cold, but others sending up steady, straight columns of flame, and of the lines of men marching off to be shot. It was all like a scene upon the stage, he wrote. So unreal, so inhuman, you felt that it could not be true, that the curtain of fire, purring and crackling, and sending up hot sparks to meet the kind, calm stars, was only a painted backdrop, that the reports of rifles from the dark rooms came from blank cartridges, and that these trembling shopkeepers and peasants, ringed in bayonets, would not in a few minutes really die, but that they themselves and their homes would be restored to their wives and children. You felt it was only a nightmare, cruel and uncivilized. And then you remembered that the German emperor has told us what it is. It is his holy war. To this medieval city had come destruction, which Davis framed as medieval in nature. Not that of a modern war, though there was much that was entirely modern about it, but of a holy one. And Davis was not alone in looking to earlier historical eras and framing what he was seeing. 2 days after Davis's story appeared in print, the Times of London published a poem by Rudyard Kipling, he of the Jungle Book and Just So stories, on the children's end of things, of the novel Kim and its depiction of the great game in Central Asia, on the more adult end. Kipling's World War I output, more generally, was, one would have to say, vigorously propagandic in nature. This was not a time of literary giants standing up to their governments, or, I should say, this was not such a case. Kipling was one of 53 British authors to sign his name that September to a declaration of support for the correctness of the British cause in restoring Belgian integrity. Authors that also included G.K. Chesterton, Arthur Conan Doyle, Thomas Hardy, and H.G. Wells. By the next year, he would be in Southport, giving a speech in aid of recruitment, and informing his audience that there was, quote, no crime, no cruelty, no abomination that the mind of men can conceive of, which the German has not perpetrated, is not perpetrating, and will not perpetrate, if he is allowed to go on. However, the world pretends to divide itself, he would tell that audience, there are only two divisions in the world today, human beings and Germans. Elsewhere, he would speak of defenses as the, quote, rampart put up by man against the beast, or Germans as being microbes that must be sterilized by, quote, measures of international hygiene. An altogether alarming piece of dehumanization. In that poem I mentioned, published in the Times, he would use a slightly different way to frame it, one that would stick. As poetry goes, it's really not to my taste. Early 20th century patriotic verses not necessarily being my thing. Quote, no easy hope or lies, it concludes, shall bring us to our goal, but iron sacrifice of body, will, and soul. There is but one task for all, one life for each to give. What stands if freedom fall? Who dies if England live? Like I said, not for me. But then, not written for me. And besides, my interest is more with the opening lines. There, Kipling would write the quote, "For all we have and are, for all our children's fate, stand up and take the war. The Hun is at the gate." In Kipling's response to the events in Louvain, and Belgium more generally, he compared the German conquerors with Attila's 5th century colleagues, who had swept into Europe, driving the Goths west, and attacking the Eastern Roman Empire. Many was not doing so to highlight the German mobility of attack, or skill with the horse, their finesse in archery, or their nomadic ways. Kipling was, of course, intending to communicate barbarism, the forces of savagery at the gates of Rome, and of civilization itself, of Europe, of Belgium, of England. It was a comparison that had been made in a much more proudly complimentary way by the Kaiser back in 1900, and in a rather less complimentary one by Kipling himself a few years after that. Kipling's pejorative sense of Hun would stick around, echoed often after his first use. I remember it from reading during my own weird World War phase as a boy, though I didn't get the reference then. British writers, among others, made much of the destruction of Louvain and the many atrocities, both real and imagined, which followed. It was all part of the larger narrative of the, quote, "Rape of Belgium," as it was called. It was said that the German soldiers had cut off the hands of children, that they'd crucified farmers along the road, that they'd rung nuns to death between church bells, bayoneted babies, and pinned the mutilated bodies of women to doors with their swords. There was really very little that they were not accused of. A lot of this was invented to help whip up anti-German feeling and support for the war effort. But not every charge that British propaganda brought against them was so cooked up. Hundreds of civilians were killed at Louvain, and just days earlier, there had been massacres and destruction in Dinant, as many more were killed or forcibly displaced throughout Belgium, in a collective punishment approach intended to terrify the people and discourage resistance. A collective punishment, possibly triggered in Louvain by panic over friendly fire incidents in the first place. Though that was, and would be, contested. By the time the German occupation forces were done there in Louvain, some 1,100 houses were destroyed. About a fifth of the city. But it might have been worse. When the American diplomat, Hugh Gibson, drove in to check on the disturbing reports he'd been hearing, he was told by a German officer, the quote, "We shall make this place a desert. We shall wipe it out so that it will be hard to find where Louvain used to stand. For generations, people will come here to see what we have done, and it will teach them to respect Germany and to think twice before they resist her. Not one stone on another, I tell you." International reaction would see those orders softened, would save the place from truly becoming the desert which the officer imagined, but not in time to save that Louvain library. What had happened there, and what had been lost? That is what we'll talk about in a moment, after this quick break.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The University of Louvain was founded in 1452, rekindling a town suffering the decline of its textile industry, and making it the first university in the Low Countries. The town became a center for Belgian printing, home to the first Belgian printer, a John of Westphalia, who was active there in the later 15th century. And then the celebrated Thierry Martens in the early 16th century. It was also home to important scholars of the period, including, at least temporarily, the humanist, theologian, and philosopher Erasmus. It would grow in colleges that numbered 46 by the end of the 16th century, each with their own book collections. By 1636, the Central Library was founded from those collections, and over the centuries, its holdings expanded, growing with its university's wealth, the privileges accorded by an 18th century Governor General of the Low Countries, the contributions of personal collections, and beneficial circumstances such as the suppression of the Jesuits, whose Louvain library the university was able to purchase from. Suffering the forcible removal of hundreds of early prints to Paris in 1794, during the reign of the Committee of Public Safety there, suffering the suppression of the university itself in 1797, to be refounded in 1816, temporarily closed again in 1830, as the Belgian Revolution gave rise to the country we know today, reopened in 1835. The library, which burned in the late August of 1914, held a collection which had passed down through the centuries virtually intact. The incursion of the French Revolution having been described by Marc Darès as only scraping the icing off the cake. The library was the reflection of the intellectual history of the Low Countries, he writes, with its various movements and controversies, such as humanism, the Reformation, the Counter-Reformation, and Jansenism. The library was home to some 200,000 to 300,000 works, with 230,000, a number that is often given. Its collection included some 800 medieval manuscripts, and over 1,000 incunabula, or early printed documents, from before 1500. That was what was lost when the soldiers entered the library late on the night of August 25th, 1914, and put fuel and incendiaries to work, destroying what had been the old weaver's hall and its contents. There's an anecdote about the rector of the American college there. He'd been rescued by the American ambassador, who recorded speaking with him after, and how, having seen his father's and brother's homes burnt, the pillaging and destruction of his town, and lines of people waiting to be shot, he, quote, told it all calmly. But there, in the hall of the university, was the library, its hundreds of thousands of volumes, its rare and ancient manuscripts, its unique collection of incunabula. All had been burned deliberately, to the last scrap. He had reached this point in his recital. He had begun to pronounce the word bibliothèque. He had said, la biblio, and he had stopped suddenly and bit his quivering lip. La bib, he went on. And then, spreading his arms on the table before him, he bowed his head upon them and wept. Perhaps it was just a case of a last straw, but of all the horrors he'd witnessed, the rector was unable to speak of this one. One manuscript survived in the hands of an escaping professor. He'd had it out to consult, and had carried it away from the ruined town, burying it within a small iron safe in a garden near Ghent, where it quite possibly might still be found, in whatever condition that iron kept it in. One 17th century fragment somehow survived to turn up in Massachusetts in 2021, kept in the Clark University archives for who knows how long, before it resurfaced during the cleaning of a filing cabinet there. Four manuscripts that had been loaned from Leiden University at the end of 1913 would not make it. One of them that was lost was a text produced in a monastery around 1463. It contained the words of a 14th century mystic, priest, and writer named Jan van Roosbroek. Fortunately, that particular text had at least been the subject of an in-depth study, and a photo had even been taken of one of its pages, available to be viewed online, if you're so inclined. Though, it's not an especially striking page, visually speaking. The librarian of the time, Paul Delannoy, described being able to view the devastation of his library, but only 8 days after the initial fire. Only at a distance, and only at personal risk. Quote, "Broken pillars, an impassable heap of bricks, stones, and beams smoldered in the fire, which slowly consumed thousands of volumes between huge portions of dangerous and threatening walls. That was all that remained of the majestic building and of the rich treasure it contained. In the streets of the ruined and deserted city, where the soldiers were completing their work of pillage, and further on, even into the country, leaves of manuscripts and books fluttered about, half burned, at the mercy of the wind." For Delannoy, the tragedy was twofold: the loss of the library's vast collection, and also that of the building itself, a quote, "gem of the most beautiful architecture of two distinct periods, the 14th and the 18th centuries." Its first stone had been laid out in 1317, its last in 1345. Delannoy outlined its two large halls, one of which had been kept pretty much as it had been, the other going through many changes. He described arches resting on pillars, the capitals ornamented with fruit and foliage. He described mighty beams of oak supported by brackets and the subjects presented there in carving: foliage, burlesque scenes, fantastic or hybrid beings. In the 17th century, one of the halls was divided into study quarters and a story added for lectures. Delannoy enthused over the decorative molding, the statues of philosophers, and the columns with their symbols of the arts and sciences. He, of course, enthused over the library's contents. The library had only just installed new bookcases with movable shelves, installed by Germans, he remarked, and the process of moving all those texts brought up to the surface all kinds of surprises and works that had gone dustily forgotten. He highlighted the mixed parchment and paper text in the hand of 15th century theologian Thomas A Kempis. He spoke of the Books of Hours, several of which were richly illuminated, of works of history, of collected lectures of celebrated professors, scarcely examined, and of those incunabula which the library had recently begun to catalog. He particularly bemoaned the loss of the theological collection that the library had also begun to catalog just 2 years earlier. In doing so, he wrote, "We came upon surprise after surprise, and the publication of the catalogs of these treasures, which had not so far been exhaustively examined, would have been of very great use to the history of the theological controversies." There were examples of 16th century Flemish bookbinding, of the work of Renaissance physician Andreas Vesalius, of the papal bull for the original founding of the university. A monument of the 14th century, Delannoy summed up his beloved library, a model of the architecture of the period, in pleasant and harmonious lines, original and varied designs. Magnificent halls, recalling by their majestic aspect and perfect sculpture, the most beautiful specimens of the Renaissance. Treasures, stored up by centuries of fruitful labor and patient research. Manuscripts, incunabula, very rare prints. Relics, piously preserved by past generations. All that is nothing compared with the delirious joy felt by a few hundreds of soldiers, drunk with wine and carnage, in contemplating the tragic spectacle of a town in flames, and in terrorizing and massacring an innocent population. Delannoy was outraged by what he'd witnessed, and for what had been lost in the fire. He was not alone in this outrage, and it was not just British writers like Kipling who made accusations of quote-unquote savagery in responding to the town's destruction, and in particular the libraries, or cast about for historical comparisons, even highly questionable ones, with which to communicate it. "Until today," wrote one man from Louvain, "I had refused to believe what the newspapers said about the atrocities committed by the Germans. But in Louvain, I have seen what their culture is like. More savage than the Arabs of Caliph Omar, who burnt down the Alexandrian Library, we see them set fire, in the 20th century, to the famous University Library." The writer, a young Jesuit who was reportedly shot, was not the only one to evoke that particular specter from the distant past. You'd see the same thing in a statement from American President Harding, who bemoaned the irreparable loss of scholarship and likened it to, quote, "the burning of the great library in Alexandria." Perhaps, like the Louvain Jesuit, referring to the 7th century period. Maybe, instead, to that of the Romans, though I don't think that Romanness would have denoted barbarism in quite the desired way in the minds of these early 20th century men. As for Louvain, its librarian promised that it was not finished, and he had some things to say about barbarism himself. "The halls of Louvain will rise again from their ashes," he wrote. "They will become, as in former days, the center of a school of learning of which the glorious past is a guarantee for the future. In building a new and magnificent library, we wish not only to restore to our professors and students those materials indispensable to all scholarship and scientific work. We wish also to show present and future generations that the civilized and right-thinking world knows how to unite in extricating barbarity as it deserves, and in solemnly avenging the intellectual and artistic patrimony of which barbarians have callously robbed it." And as to rising again, he was right. Louvain would rise again, its library's reconstruction and restocking a matter mentioned in the Treaty of Versailles, and also supported with books from England, the US, and Japan, among other sources. There were difficulties with funding, and disagreements over details. The unfortunate proposed Latin inscription, to read, "Destroyed by German fury, rebuilt by American donations," among them. But the work would be done. The library, in the 1930s, was back on its feet. But cruelly, it would not remain that way. On the night of May 16th, 1940, war returned to Louvain, along with the German army, and the library was burned again. Blame for the destruction cast about between the British and Germans. Louvain again, ran a headline in the Times. A librarian at Louvain wrote to his Columbia University colleague that, quote, "I am indeed grieved, having to tell you that the library was nearly completely gutted by fire. That the fine stack rooms at the back, housing our precious collections, are no more, and that only terribly twisted and molten girders remain of it. It is painful to behold. Gone also the collection of incunabula, manuscripts, medals, precious china, silk flags, and catalogues. Practically, we have to start again at the bottom." The entire process of rebuilding and refilling those shelves, managed only painfully recently, would need to begin again. But it would be done. In 1950, the library at the University of Louvain was again reopened. And it is still in use today, and, I trust, safe from fire for the foreseeable future. I hope you've enjoyed this slight departure from the podcast's usual focus. We will be back to more familiar territory next time, with an episode about a 15th century Italian physician and engineer. Thank you very much for listening. I'll talk to you then.
Human Circus will return.
Save big money and transform your home with new appliances now at Menards. We offer the lowest prices and the largest in-stock appliance selection ready to take home today. Check out top appliance brands, including KitchenAid, Maytag, Whirlpool, Amana, and Criterion. Upgrade your home and save big money on new appliances at Menards. Shop our entire selection of appliance options online today at Menards.com. Save big money.